Well, we originally, when we came, we departed from Montreal, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I think we were escaping Montreal, and we are both teachers in the CEJAP system there.
Mm-hmm.
And we purchased this land as a kind of a summer type of retreat, but eventually we moved there when we got set up with life in Montreal. So it goes back quite a long way. We had a young daughter in Montreal, and we decided that we would try our hand at all the theory that we had originally sort of collected. We had a little table in our dining room with plants and seedlings, and we used to subscribe to a magazine called the Mother. Was it called the Mother Earth?
Mother Earth.
Mother Earth News, and we tried a lot of little experiments and growing things in our yard. And eventually we got set up with Montreal. We took the plunge and quit our jobs and moved out there. It was a time when I think it was difficult for English-speaking Montrealers. We're not originally from Montreal, though. So it was an escape, I think. Mark can qualify that if you think differently.
Yeah, I think so. We had both been in school for many years. We wound up being teachers, and we became interested in sustainable agriculture. Small is Beautiful. There was a book out on that. And actually, the real thing that happened to me is I was driving a Volkswagen Beetle, and I bought a book that said, it was a book on how to tune up your Volkswagen Beetle.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought the parts, and this is when we were still in Montreal, and I tuned up my car. I had never done something like that before. And that led to us buying a farm in rural PEI and moving to rural PEI and basically learning how to run a subsistence farm. So that's a little bit of the background. At the time, I had two university degrees, and Joyce had two as well. So we both had two each.
Okay. And you mentioned you weren't from Montreal. Were you from Ontario?
We were both born in Toronto, and between moving to PEI from Montreal, we had moved to Winnipeg for a few years after we were originally first married. Then we moved from Winnipeg to Montreal and Montreal to PEI. But I'm a Torontonian. My whole family was here and has been here. And we were just in Winnipeg for a very short time, and Montreal for a short time as well. So that was kind of the move from one location to the other. And rural Prince Edward Island was a totally about which, because we are not rural people. We are, you know, we are from metropolitan Toronto, basically.
Sure. The year was 1975. It was June of 1975 that we moved finally to our home in Prince Edward Island, which was located in the New London area on a road called the Wigmore Road.
Wigmore, okay.
We bought a farmhouse built in 1909. We paid $6,000 for it, and no plumbing, no central heating, just really a house. And we bought the adjoining land of 50 acres for another $5,000. So for $11,000, we had a small farm, and we were ready to go.
Right.
We also tried to get some of our friends to move from Montreal, actually, to move down there. And a few of them did buy some land, but they never moved down there. We moved down in increments. So we would go down in the summers and then Christmas time. And eventually found we were more drawn to Prince Edward Island than to staying in the city. So eventually we just packed up and moved down there. But our friends who purchased the land never made that move. So.
Was it 1975 that you started the incremental move, or 1975 when you moved full-time?
Well, we bought the house in 1973.
Okay.
From a neighbor. And just a little bit before that, in 1972, we had come through Prince Edward Island for the first time. We had spent the summer on the Magdalen Islands, and on our way back, we met some people on the ferry boat from Magdalen to Surrey, who invited us to overnight on their farm, a little farm, a beautiful little farm and piece of land in Irishtown, which is just north of Kensington. That they had rented for the summer, and it was just, I remember it was August, it was beautiful, and that's when we decided we would come back the next summer, which was 73. Mm-hmm. We bought a house in 73 and then moved down in increments between 73 and 75. The final telling piece was that in 75, when we finally built a garden, started a garden for the first time. We were there for the summer. We had taken a leave of absence from our jobs as teachers, and we bought a deep freeze. And all of a sudden, there was food in the deep freeze. We had bought a dog. We had a house, and we really had no reason to go back to Montreal. And that was the end of Montreal and the beginning of 5 years on Prince Edward Island. We left in August of 1980, so we were there from June of 75 to August of 1980.
And I should say that, I don't know if you have a question, but we came with our daughter, and in 1977, our son was born in our farmhouse with a lay midwife, so that we sort of went the whole hippie way. He was, born there and was always there, so it was something we decided we didn't want to involve the medical establishment, and we had our second child in our farmhouse on the Wigmore Road.
Wow, so you went wholehearted in.
Yeah.
Wholehearted in. Lots of stock
and barrels. And at the time that we were, we eventually got some small animals and a Jersey cow and other kinds of small goats. We had an eatery, and we really did try to be sustainable and organic and create and make all our own food and then also clothing. I did weaving and dyeing, so we were doing the whole thing.
And in fact, we were sustainable. I would say that about 90% of our food and our requirements for heat in the winter were taken care of by ourselves.
Yeah. So your connection to PEI, was it just this visit that you made during the trip to the Magdalens, or had you come here?
We just found it idyllic.
That's it. August in Irishtown, there's no place like it. But February, and also February in Irishtown, there's no place like it.
Really? You don't hear that as often.
Well, I'm not saying that positively. I'm saying the winters were long and cold.
Yeah, it was actually, I think, more difficult for women, at least for myself. I felt I was really isolated. Men tend to be able to find, I mean, I had small children, so I think men tend to find ways of getting out of the farmhouse, even in the worst of weather and even when they shouldn't, and go and meet other people and do things. But it was really hard. I mean, we couldn't even drive up our drive. We had snowshoe in. It was really, really hard. We lived on the top of a hill. Mm-hmm. And in the winter, it was, the drifts of the snow were huge, so we'd have to carry our children in backpacks and our groceries and snowshoe in. And in the springtime, it was equally bad because our road wasn't paved, so the runoff from the top of the drive would cause a fissure in the drive that would just separate out. It was just huge red mud up to your knees. It was really, really hard. And the road wasn't paved either, which made it had to come in by tractor.
Okay.
It was really hard.
I should also tell you as well that we also needed to earn money. And while we were self-sufficient food-wise, I recall having four different types of jobs while I was there, all of which were part-time. Firstly, I taught a course in the Extension Department at the University of Prince Edward Island in sociology, and I would do introductory sociology in communities, including in O'Leary, in Summerside, and in Charlottetown, and I would have basically a course to teach each semester, and I think I was paid $1,500 for that, and that sustained us a little bit. Secondly, I also decided to become a chimney sweep, and I started a small company called Black Knight, the Black Knight Chimney Sweep. I taught myself how to clean chimneys, and believe it or not, I made a bit of money cleaning chimneys, and if you go back into the newspaper, the Charlottetown Guardian paper back in the period of, say, 77, 78, 79, I ran a daily ad in the paper, and the ad said, Black Knight Chimney Sweep, cash or barter, cash or barter. And I go out and clean people's chimneys and make some money. The barter was interesting. I remember once cleaning someone's chimney, and what I got for cleaning the chimney was a large roast of beef. But we figured that the roast of beef was worth more than the chimney cleaning. And so in change, I gave this guy a chicken. And I also bartered for a gallon of red paint that I needed for some reason. And I also bartered for an old piece of horse-drawn farm machinery that I needed. This guy this fellow had a, I don't, can't remember what it was. It was some old piece of machinery, and I had a tractor, and I needed it, so I cleaned his chimney. He gave me this piece of horse-drawn equipment to pull behind my tractor. So that was the second job. The third job that I had is that I was hired by the Prince Edward Island Human Rights Commission and became their first executive director part-time. So I was the first executive director of the Prince Edward Island Human Rights Commission, interestingly enough, until a year and a half later when I was fired. And I'll tell you that story in a minute. The third job, the fourth job that I had is that I was the first freelancer that worked for CBC Charlottetown that opened in 1977. The producer was Jeff Turnbull. I did radio spots or human interest spots for the morning show on CBC Radio. And my story, one of my stories, was the first story to ever air when that station opened in, I can't remember the month, it was probably the fall of 1977. And so I made a bit of money selling human interest stories throughout the countryside to CBC Charlottetown. The human rights story ends with me being fired for a number of reasons, the least of which was I was told that I was not a lawyer and therefore could not interpret the Prince Edward Island Human Rights Code when it came to discrimination issues. So I did two things. I sued the Human Rights Commission for wrongful dismissal, and I won. And I went to law school. I'm thankful that they fired me. And in fact, the part of my practice now, interestingly enough, is in the area of employment dismissal and international human rights. I have an international human rights practice, so it was a seminal moment when I was told that I couldn't read the Human Rights Code because I wasn't a lawyer, and I was fired. I turned it into a career. I should also tell you that my lovely wife Joyce also had occasional part-time jobs working as a dental hygienist. So she would sometimes work in dental offices cleaning the teeth of islanders.
I also had a job that I was fired from as well. Here and there as well. I was there was a real difficulty there with the local people who didn't want me to carry out a study on French immersion in the school system there. It wasn't a study that had been well thought out, and I was hired by somebody off the island to do an observation type of study in the classrooms, observing their children in French immersion. And it wasn't well accepted by the parents, and eventually, and then I was fired before I even sort of got going. And I also sued and succeeded on that case, and I subsequently became, I sued for wrongful dismissal. Mark did this thing again with us that case, and I subsequently became a lawyer as well. So.
And to complete that circle, not only is Joyce a lawyer, but one of her specialty areas is in dental malpractice. In fact, she's one of Canada's foremost experts in that area, combining dental hygiene or knowledge of dentistry with the practice of law. So what drove us ultimately away from Prince Edward Island, a couple of things. I mean, the least of which is that we were both fired from city-type jobs where we were trying to earn a small living. We were both fired from that. And after 5 years of life in the country, it started to become very tedious. Remember, we're not country folk. We don't have country in our blood. We were, more or less, I would say, educated kind of pseudo intellectual city types that thought they could learn how to live sustainably and wanted to experiment with that. And after 4 or 5 years of discovering that when you plant a mixture of oats and barley, all things being equal, and the rains come, it grows and you get grain, the thrill kind of left.
Yeah, but
and at least from my perspective, I needed more of a challenge, and Prince Edward Island was in terms of jobs or things more than just sustainable agriculture, basically forced us away.
Well, that and I think what has made it more palatable is if we hadn't had the rejections by the larger community, the people on our road, the local people, were very accepting and really enjoyed having us there. But when we tried to enter into, I guess, more of the professional level in Charlottetown, we had difficulties being accepted and assimilated somehow. It was more difficult. And it became quite a challenge. And we realized that we could probably go on and do something else outside of that community. And I think the other thing that drove us away is that our daughter at the time was just beginning to show a real interest and an ability in dance. Eventually, we realized that the training she could receive in Charlottetown as a ballet student was very limited. And we moved to Halifax, and she continued her training, eventually became a professional dancer. So it was hard for her. Our son might have done better, I think, on the farm because he was born there, and maybe his horizons wouldn't have been as challenged initially, although he, too, now, he's a lawyer now, too, but at the time he was just a little baby, and I think had he stayed there and he was brought up there, he might have done quite well, I think, in the rural area, because he really still enjoys that kind of a life. It doesn't have any recall whatsoever of ever even being on a farm, unfortunately.
I think to be analytical, if I may for a moment, Prince Edward Island in the late 70s, as Joyce said, our neighbors who were the farming community were wonderful people, salt of the earth people, and people who I grew very fond of. But we were not fundamentally farmers. We were triflers. And when we tried to become part of, let's say, the mainstream professional grouping of people in Charlottetown, our experience was that of being rejected and as outsiders. I was hired by the Human Rights Commission because I was Jewish, am Jewish, in my view, and had no connection to the established order in Charlottetown as it was at the time. And I was also fired, in my view, partly because I was Jewish, by a commission composed of people who I considered to not fundamentally understand discrimination or anti-discrimination, and had no concept at all of what human rights meant. I was fired because I was Jewish, fundamentally, in my view, from a discriminatory commission. I'll give you one other anecdote. I investigated, when I worked for the Human Rights Commission, a complaint of political discrimination that exists in the Human Rights Act and TEI, and concluded that there had been political discrimination. This particular individual, when the government changed one spring, lost his job working for the Parks Department, and he filed a complaint of discrimination because he didn't vote for the right party. I found discrimination, reported it to the commission, who then called the Minister of Tourism into a meeting. I was at the meeting, and I don't recall the minister's name. During the course of that meeting, the Minister of Tourism at the time reached into his pocket, pulled out an envelope that had something in the range of $2,000 in cash in it, gave it to the chairman of the Human Rights Commission, and said, you know, we feel really bad that he lost his job. See to it that he gets this money. I was horrified. The cure for a human rights complaint is not just an apology. It's also a social righting of a wrong, and to do this quietly under the table was fundamentally wrong, and again demonstrated to me to what extent PEI in the late 70s was in many respects politically and socially a backwater. I hope it's not that way today. And there was no room for us in Prince Edward Island, and we had to leave. And in fact, there was another incident. There was, at that time, the Charlottetown Industrial Park was starting to develop.
Right.
And the Human Rights Code gave us the right to analyze employment application forms, to take out from them any potential discriminatory questions that, for example, would prevent women from getting jobs on the basis of having children, or prevent ethnic or ethnic minorities, just questions that ask, you know, what is your ethnic background, what's your marital status, how many kids, and we had our act gave us the right to investigate that. The commission would not allow me to do that. They felt that it was better to attract jobs to the island rather than to see to it that jobs were given out in a non-discriminatory fashion. So I was a little bit too urban for them, and in the end, we obviously went on to bigger and better things, but I regret having to leave PEI very much. That's a bit far afield from what you might think of as kind of your hippie back to the lander, because we were hippie back to the landers.
Mm-hmm. We did actually do a lot. I mean, we had animals, animal husbandry. We had milk goats. We used to take our goats to goat shows and show them. They were like purebred Toggenburg goats. I had a very large organic garden, like huge. I did my gardening 6-8 hours a day. I was outside constantly. and we had a little greenhouse. So even in the wintertime, we were planning for the summer planting and ordering a seed through the Bessie seed catalog and starting our seedlings. I was very much into gardening, and we marketed any excess vegetables we had at the local, what was the root cellar. Besides the animals we had and the vegetables that we sold all the excess honey. We had lots of honey. I don't know whether honey is as bountiful as it was then. We had really nice honey we sold. I did all the baking, like 12 loaves of bread in a wood oven, which was totally, with all these baffles and amazing oven. I could cook anything in, so I made lots of bread and sold the excess. I made butter with our Jersey Chow 3 times a week and had lots of cream. And we had, different fowl, chickens, ducks, et cetera.
I'll tell you if you can take 2 quick anecdotes.
Oh, sure.
Anecdotes. So I knew nothing about farming, and I bought an old tractor, and I got a plow, and I got a harrow, and I got what I needed. And I got the seed ready, and I kind of cleaned the seed, and I was ready to sow. And my neighbors were very helpful. I mean, they were giving me lots of tips. This is what you do, and this is how you do it, and this is how you do it, and get ready and clean the seed. And finally, I was ready. It was the day of readiness. And one of my neighbors, a fellow by the name of Borden McAllister, I remember him well, a tobacco-chewing, tobacco-spitting guy, the salt of the earth. By the way, you knew that Borden McAllister considered you a friend. I knew that he considered me a friend the day that he came up to my farmhouse and he was holding a pair of vice grips and he made a lunge at my testicles with the vice grip. I knew that I was his friend when he did that. It was just for fun. But anyway, so I get ready to do it, and Borden McAllister drives into my yard and says, runs up to me and says, "Mark, before you do it, I got to tell you one thing. If you don't turn the heads of grain head down, it won't sprout." And I stopped and said, "Wait a second. I'm sowing a ton of seed. You mean I got to turn every little head by hand? Every little seed with the head down? I can't do that." And he smiled at me, and I knew he was joking. So that was a kind of Borden McAllister's joke. The other thing that my other neighbor suggested one day, we decided we were going to put we had a hen that wanted to become a mother, a laying hen or a clucking hen. A neighbor came over and said, "You could put duck eggs under that chicken, and she'd hatch ducks for you." So we bought some fertile duck eggs, put them under the chicken, and sure enough, 3 weeks later, she hatched out these little ducklings, which was a hoot. For 3 or 4 weeks, they followed her around, and then one day there was a big rain, and the little ducks headed for the mud puddle, and the mother hen, I remember, was beside herself with grief, couldn't believe it, and abandoned them in the farmyard. Eventually, those ducks made their way into the deep freeze. So we're kind of into that.
When you're on the Wigmore Road, were there other, I'm doing the air quotes, back to the landers on the road?
Not on our road. No, we were the only ones on our road. Our neighbors looked at us. They were very good, very, very friendly. But I think they were somewhat suspect as to why we would choose to live there when we weren't from there.
But they tried to really include me. I remember the Women's Institute, whatever meetings I got invited to them. In fact, I was asked to come and speak at one meeting because I did weaving, and they asked me to come and show my weaving, and I did. I actually won some prizes at a fair. So they, what fair was that? I can't remember. There's a winter fair or summer fair. I can't remember. But they came. They asked me to come and talk, show what I did, and they were very welcoming. One very funny thing I remember happened is that we were still at that time on a telephone that had a party line. And you always knew that somebody was picking up the phone, even as gently as they tried to be when they picked it up when you were talking. But I remember one day, Mark and I decided that evening we wanted to go to Charlottetown to go to a movie or some sort of entertainment because we rarely went out. And we didn't have a babysitter, and we had these kids. And I said, "Mark, well, I guess you can't go. We don't have a babysitter." And I was talking to somebody on the phone about that, another person. And we just resigned ourselves to the fact that we'd stay in. About 5 minutes later, the phone rang and it said, "Hey, I hear you need a babysitter." And apparently the neighbors had phoned around and figured out who would babysit for us because they'd been listening and on our telephone, my telephone conversation with somebody else. And it was very funny. I mean, I knew that they listened, but I didn't know that they were that keen on helping us in that way. But it was helpful. But it was a kind of an interesting situation. Everybody knew everybody's business. And then it wasn't in a mean way. They were generous, and the local, our next door neighbor, two neighbors, and she used to always babysit for our children. She would, when I always offer, and if I had to go in and work in the city, or if I wanted to go into Charlottetown because I worked out at the Y occasionally, I could always count on her to take care of our kids. She was amazing.
However, not to say that things did also not have a sinister side in the country. They did. And a lot of that sinister side was fueled by alcohol. Many of our neighbors, I believe, were alcoholics. I told you that when we first moved there, we had a deep freeze and we had a dog. In fact, we bought a beautiful black Labrador from one of the neighbors. And sometime around a year after we had lived there, our black lab went missing. It wasn't like that dog. It was a very smart dog to disappear. Our black dog went missing. And about a day and a half later, I got a phone call from someone over on the other side of the hill, and I think in an area called Granville, who called me up and said, "I hear your dog's missing." I said, "Yeah." He said, "You can come and get it. I shot it. It's dead in my yard." And I was beside myself, and this was in the wintertime, why anyone would shoot a dog. And I got in the car, got in the truck. They told me where the farm was. It was on the other side from us, a little bit east of us. I got in the truck and slowly drove over into this other farmyard. And sure enough, lying in the middle of this farmyard was our beautiful black lab, dead, having been shot by this neighbor. And I walked into this yard, and the people who lived there, I didn't know these people, the farm family that had lived there, that were living there, I could see them standing at the door and at the window looking at me. And I looked back at them. And if there is a moment where you can take revenge or have vengeance for someone, that was the moment. And I looked at them, and they looked at me, and all I could feel for them was pity. I didn't feel anger, I felt pity. And I picked up the body of our black dog, put him on the back of the truck, drove back to our farm. It was the wintertime. I took the dog down to the creek and laid him on a snowbank. And when the spring came along, when the earth had thawed out, I dug a little grave, and I put his name on a tree. The name was Niku. Niku was the name chosen by our daughter when we had first moved to Prince Edward Island. And so there was a sinister side. A couple of years later, we had the same thing happen again, this time to a white lab with another neighbor who shot it dead. So things were a little bit sinister in the country, and as I say, it was fueled to a large extent by alcoholism. And to a large extent, I shouldn't say to a large extent, to some extent, some of the people that lived in the country, I think, were very troubled people.
The second dog, I actually couldn't believe that it happened because I had taken my son and a little umbrella stroller for a long walk, and I had my daughter, and we went to visit this family around the corner because my daughter went to school with this little boy. And we were inside, and I left our dog outside because I didn't bring a dog into the farmhouse, and having tea with this woman. And when I came out, I called, it was a female dog, Cindy. I said, Cindy, we couldn't find her. And we said, what's going on? Why can't she come? She's not coming, which was, again, very unlike our dog. And I couldn't find her anywhere. And I put signs up all over, everywhere, saying if anybody had seen her. And nobody would say anything. But then our neighbor across the street then told us that, in fact, when I was in visiting that family, the husband shot our dog outside the house. I don't know why.
And in fact, there was a very strong underbelly to Prince Edward Island. By the way, not unlike any other community. Mm-hmm. I want to suggest that there are no underbellies here in Toronto. There are many.
For sure.
Many underbellies in virtually every community. So, yeah, the beautiful August in Irishtown, where we fell in love with PEI, rapidly vanishes in the dead of winter you know, when your neighbors are driving drunk down the highway in their pickup trucks, and in fact, someone was killed on one of the roads in the area of Granville in one of the winters that we were there. One of the neighbors driving his truck plowed him down and drunk and killed him. So, you know, I mean, what can I say? Alcoholism is pervasive in every community.
Sure.
In the end, PEI was unfortunately, sadly, too small for us. And they shot our dogs. Our neighbors, close neighbors, were great. Some neighbors shot our dogs. We were fired from our jobs, and we needed to get back.
Well, the other incident that I found is that our daughter used to drive on the school bus. We lived across the street from the school bus driver, so she was on it a long time, first in the bus, last off. She was a little, she was born at the time of year where she would be the youngest one on the bus, she was very, very young. But she used to get picked on a lot because I tried really hard to make sure she had healthy food and didn't eat the kinds of what I consider and still consider now are unhealthy foods. And the kids would make fun of her for bringing whole wheat bread and carob cookies or whatever they were. And she was really had a very hard time. And they pitied her. They used to mock her and say that I was mean and that she was to be, you know, there was really a shame she had to live with people like that, her parents. They made it very difficult for her. She was very, you know, very impressionable and very young. And fortunately for her, she had this outlet, this creative outlet, which I made sure she had pretty much every day. I used to drive into Charlottetown with her and pick her up at school, the consolidated school in Kensington, drive all the way from Kensington to Charlottetown, pick her up and take her to her ballet lesson. For her, that was a real outlet.
Who did she dance with, Joyce? Do you remember Katie Mason?
Katie Mason. I don't know if she's around, but she started with Katie Mason, and it was the Prince Edward Island Ballet Association or whatever it was called then. And I mean, it was very hard for a young outsider girl who, I can't say that all the families were like that, because there was a young girl that was very, very good to our daughter, and she was a bit older, and I used to take this other girl to the ballet when we would go, and I'd take her to cultural events. And we went back a few years, I guess it was quite a while, 98, and I saw this girl that had been our daughter's very good friend, and she came to visit us, children of her own, and she said one of the things that she recalls that she is so thankful for was the cultural events that I included her in and bought tickets and took her along with, because she never would have had that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened with her is that she eventually went to university and became a social worker. So she says that it was my giving her the inspiration to achieve more, because her family were farmers, and that's all she probably would have aspired to had she not got some sort of exposure when I included her. So she was, you know, she was actually thanking me, but a lot of the other neighbors were not very thankful of it. I think they saw the difference, and they were either envious of it, but they did not really treat our daughter very well, some of the children.
I'll tell you one other quick anecdote. When I taught, I mean, I don't want to give an entirely, this is not entirely sinister. We had some wonderful times, and there were some wonderful people. I taught a course in O'Leary, and there were farmers' wives who were just a wonderful group of people, but I remember specifically two nuns took my introductory sociology course. And, of course, they knew that I was Jewish, and I was quite proud of the fact. And as the course was winding down, we were on our last day, the nuns came up to me and they said, Mark, they said, you are such a Catholic person. Christian, sorry. They called me a Catholic. They said, you are such a Catholic person. And they meant it in the very positive sense of the word that I actually was very complimented by.
Mm-hmm.
If you know what I mean. I mean, all of the good things that mm-hmm. Catholic people are,
okay,
they considered me to be. And it was an interesting kind of twist, because they knew I was Jewish. On the other hand, Father Jim Kelly, at Christmas was approaching. I remember one day I was in the Human Rights Commission office, and Father Kelly came in, and I could see he was very uncomfortable, and he said, Mark, he said, you know, I've always respected your people, and I don't know what you do at Christmas time. And he put his hand in his pocket, and he took out a $20 bill, and he put it in my hand and said, but here, buy yourself something. And his comment about, you know, I don't know much about your people, struck me as somewhat strange. But he gave me generously a gift, and I just wondered whether it was, I couldn't quite, it was like mixed messages, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah. But as I say, the majority of people that we met and encountered on our road and the farmers in the neighborhood were open-minded and welcoming, embracing, and friendly, and were good, solid neighbors and good, solid, salt-of-the-earth people. They really were. The sinister ones were really the exception. By the way, just as an aside, Joyce and I were in Indonesia a few months ago, and we were on the island of Java. We were visiting a historical ruin, and two young men took our tour guide aside and said something in the native language, and our tour guide then came to us and said, these two young men are from the island of Sarawak. They had never seen a white Westerner, and they would wonder if you would let them have a picture with you. And I said, of course, and I can't imagine. Can you imagine in today's day? And so there we are off on some other island where, I mean, these were dark-skinned people that had never seen a white Westerner.
Yeah.
And they asked to be photographed with us. So, you know, the world is a, and I was not offended in the least. In fact, I was quite honored to be pictured with them. I just even taking the pictures home and saying, wow, look what we saw when we were in Java, two white guys from North America. And so one gets got, you know, and that's kind of the good sense that I got in Prince Edward Island. Most people were kind of curious and interested and interesting. We had an old guy who used to grow wheat up in Rustico. What was his name, Joyce? Can't remember his name. I mean, he was part Rowling. Guy Rowling. Do you know that name?
Guy Rowling. No.
He's long gone, I'm sure, but he had a son, and they had an organic wheat. His son was Art. Art Rowling. And they grew wheat organically. They would haul seaweed up from the shore, put it on their fields. And, of course, we knew the Cork brothers down in North Rustico, right at the end of the pier. I don't know if you remember if they're still there or not. There's a family of Cork brothers that were fishermen that took tourists out to fish mackerel out in the strait. Who were just wonderful, wonderful characters. Fished with them and had a great time with them. And I remember Beard Court would hold court at his fillet table with filleting mackerel or cod and just putting on a big show for all the tourists coming through. And just wonderful salt-of-the-earth people.
Hmm. So you mentioned you both had 2 degrees by the time you came to PEI. What were your...
I had my Bachelor of Arts degree and a Master of Arts in Sociology.
Okay.
Joyce had a Dental Hygiene diploma from the University of Toronto and a Bachelor of Arts, which she picked up in Montreal.
Okay, okay.
We left PEI. I left to go to law school. I picked up a degree from Dalhousie in law in 1983. Joyce got her law degree in 1986. Joyce actually got a Master. Oh, Joyce reminds me. Joyce got her Master of Science degree at Dalhousie in 1981 or 82 in health education. And then got a law degree in 1986. And then I went on, when I got back to Toronto, I got a Master of Law, an LLM, in I think, 1999. So I now have 4, and Joyce has 4
mm-hmm.
degrees, too educated to shake a stick at. I say fundamentally, we were not farmers. We were not back to the landers. We were, and I say intellectuals or pseudo-intellectuals who found the whole concept of sustainability interesting, but once we figured out that we could do it, we needed to go on to bigger and better things. And I recall in my last winter cleaning chimneys, saying to my customers, I'm cleaning chimneys, right? I'm saying to my customers, I won't be back next year. I'm going to law school. I mean, talk about a 180-degree turn and a juxtaposition of cleaning chimneys and law school.
Mm-hmm.
We live in a house in Toronto that's worth $1.5 million.
Yeah.
Our first house we paid for $6,000 in Prince Edward Island. You know, we have a small fruit garden. You know, we no longer heat with wood. We are on the grid and we're beholden to the man. We are backsliders big time.